Morning, saints. Down to a skeleton crew this morning, but that's all right. Right, if you've got your Bibles, last year we worked through the book of James, and we're still not finished. So turn to the book of James, and we're up to chapter 5. James chapter 5. The last thing we looked at in James was really at the end of chapter 4 about the frailty of life. And he talked about what is your life, you know, it's only a vapour. And we talked about how that we live our lives like we're going to be here forever. But we're here such a short amount of time, really, and the reality of that. What's that?
2 hours and 40 minutes.
We're here 2 hours. Very good, Bob. So make use of your 2 hours. Yeah. Yeah. I better make this quick then. Yeah. All right, so we get up to chapter 5, and James changes tact a little bit. So I want to look at probably eight verses, maybe. So yeah, it says, right, verse 1, "Come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries that are coming upon you. Your riches are corrupted, and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver are corroded, and their corrosion will be a witness against you, and it will eat your flesh like fire. You have heaped up treasure in the last days. Indeed, the wages of the labourers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, cry out, and the cries of the reapers have reached the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth. You have lived on the earth in pleasure and luxury. You have fattened your hearts as in a day of slaughter. You have condemned, you have murdered the just, he does not resist you." So James, first of all, he's going for the rich, okay? And it's a warning toward the rich. Now the context of this is the Jews, it's a book that's written to Jewish believers, and the Jewish believers again were persecuted and scattered. And the rich ones that were amongst them were actually persecuting these believers. And it was probably the Sanhedrin and those sort of groups. So James he's actually prophesying and warning the rich. And he starts off and he says, "Come now, you rich, weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon you." This book was written in probably about 45 to 50 AD. And we know that the judgment that was coming upon Israel because of the rejection of the Messiah was only coming something like 20 years later. In AD 70, probably 20 years later, it wasn't long before Jerusalem was totally levelled and everything was plundered and all of their lives were killed and they were scattered from then on. So it's only 20 years after James is giving this little warning to the rich that, look, he says, weep and howl because of the miseries that are actually coming upon you. So the rich here in this passage are guilty of three main things. The first thing is fraud. And in verse 4 it says, "Indeed, the wages of the labourers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, they cry out, and the cries of the reapers have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts." The Greek word for fraud actually means to withhold by a legal technicality. And so here you've got there's nothing wrong with riches. There's nothing wrong with being rich. It's actually what you do with those riches and what you do with your wealth. And James isn't condemning them for being rich, but he's condemning them because of what they do. And the first thing that he condemns them for is that there's a legal technicality that they're withholding money back. So it's actually fraud. And he's saying that this is going to work against them. It says that they've kept the money back by fraud. And that money actually cries out. There's two things that cry out that reach the ears of the Lord. It's the money that's been done by the injustice. And the second one is the cries of those reapers. They actually hear. The Lord hears those cries. The second thing he says in verse 5, he says, you've lived on the earth in pleasure and in luxury, and you've fattened your hearts as in the day of slaughter. So again, there's nothing wrong with riches, but unfortunately these people, their only concern was for themselves. They didn't care about the poor. They didn't care about using what God had given them to actually benefit those around them. Everything was self-centered. Everything was about them. Everything was about them living in luxury. And it says that they'd fattened their hearts as in the day of slaughter. It's interesting. I read a commentary on AD 70. When the armies did come in and take Jerusalem, they actually looked for the plump ones. They looked for the plump Jews. The rich Jews, ones that had heaps of money and heaps of food, and they were the ones that actually got tortured. The skinny ones they left alone. And James here is saying, you know, you lived in pleasure and luxury, you've fattened your hearts as in the day of slaughter. The last thing that he really condemns them for is that they've condemned and they've murdered the just. He does not resist you. This can either be two things. It can either be addressed toward the Sanhedrin that had the Messiah falsely accused and murdered, or it can refer to the Jewish body of believers at that time, and they were not fighting back. Yes, they were persecuted. Yes, they were scattered all in amongst. They were injustices were continually done toward them, but they turned the other cheek. They did not resist that which was done to them. And James is saying that all of these people, the rich and the ones that are doing this, their day's coming. Their day is coming. This also has an application for the last days on earth, that the rich and those that have abused people with their wealth, there's a day coming for them also. He's not only speaking for his own time, but he's speaking for an age to come, that the rich will have its day. And if you really want to make a rich man cry, you remove his money. And, yeah. So he goes on, and then he first of all, he attacks the rich. And then he starts on a different tangent, and he actually talks to those that have been abused. These are these Jewish believers that are scattered everywhere. And in verse 7 and 8, I really just want to spend a little bit of time there, and we'll have a look at that. He says, therefore, be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, waiting patiently for it until it receives the early and the latter rain. You also, be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. For a Jew, when he would have heard this first term, see how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, waiting patiently for it until it receives the early and the latter rain, it would have reminded him of a passage in Deuteronomy. Have a look at Deuteronomy chapter 11. Deuteronomy chapter 11 from verse 8. We'll read through there. Deuteronomy 11 verse 8, and he says, therefore, you shall keep every commandment which I commanded you today, that you may be strong and go in and possess the land which you cross over to possess. So this is Moses speaking through God about them before they actually crossed over into the land. And he says, and that you may prolong your days in the land which the Lord swore to give to your fathers, to them and to their descendants, a land flowing with milk and honey. For the land which you go to possess is not like the land of Egypt from which you have come, where you sowed your seed and you watered it by foot as a vegetable garden. But the land which you cross over to possess is a land of hills and valleys, which drinks waters from the rain of heaven, a land for which the Lord your God cares, and the eyes of the Lord your God are always on it from the beginning of the year to the very end of the year. And it shall be that if you earnestly obey my commandments, which I command you today, to love the Lord your God and to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul, then I will give you the rain for your land in its season, the early rain and the latter rain, that you may gather in your grain, your new wine and your oil. And I will send grass in your fields for your livestock, that you may eat and be filled. Yet take heed to yourselves, lest your heart be deceived and you turn aside and serve other gods and worship them. And lest the Lord's anger be aroused against you and he shut up the heavens so that there be no rain and the land yield no produce and you perish quickly from the good land which the Lord is giving you. So for the Jew, when he heard this term, it would have reminded him of what God had said about the early and the latter rain. And what God is saying in there is that farming in the promised land is very, very different to that which they had experienced previously. Back in Egypt, he says in verse 10, "For the land which you go to possess is not like the land of Egypt from which you came, where you sowed your seed and you watered it by foot as a vegetable garden." Back in Egypt, they had the Nile River and they could dig channels. They had an abundant amount of water by which they could use. They could irrigate it by hand. It was no problem. So when you look at it, it's actually easy gardening for the Jew. It was easy gardening. It was easy for them to water their vegetables. It was easy farming because they had that much access to water. But God is saying to these people that he's going to actually lead them to a land that is not like the land of Egypt. It won't be easy. This land receives its rain from the sky. It's a land of hills and it's a land of valleys. Back in Egypt, they didn't have to show any faith concerning their livelihood because the water was accessible. Yet God was going to lead the Jews to a land that they had to actually receive the rain in some other way. And he says in this thing here that they had to keep his commandments. They had to keep diligently in the things of God. And if they did that, then God would actually let the rains come down and water their crops. Very different. So their whole farming methods had to change. They still had to sow the seed. They still had to do everything that they did, but they were absolutely dependent upon the rain coming down from heaven. And it's in the early seasons, which was October through to November, and the latter seasons, which was about March, April. Completely different. They still had to work, but they actually had to exercise faith that God would actually bring the rain to produce a harvest for their crops. So it interests me that God would actually lead them to a land that was actually not going to be easy for them, you know? And when you think about it for our own lives, for you it might be like the land of Egypt for you at the moment. Things might be easy. You know, you may not be having to exercise faith toward God in certain areas of your life, but for others it might be like you've been taken to this new land and things are completely different. Things are actually really hard. You're going to have to work really hard and your need of God is going to be a lot greater. Back in Egypt, they could just water everything, their livelihood. But here in the land of Canaan, they were absolutely dependent upon God giving the rain. There was nothing they could do. All they had to do was farm. They still had to sow the seed and they still had to tend to their crops as you would. But the rain that would give the harvest and that would bring all the fruit to maturity came from somewhere else. It actually came from God. And when I was thinking about that, I thought, you know, our lives are much like that. God brings us into areas that require us to look toward him. And it's not easy at times. There's times of real easy walking and there's times of real great difficulty. And it's just the way it is. But God, in all of it, is wanting his children. And he is desiring that what he brings out in us is a dependence upon him. For the farmer, he still had to sow a seed. He still had to take the weeds out, do everything he could so that his crop could grow. But the produce and the life came from the rain. And God has said to him, if you're obedient and you stay in those things, then I'll give you the rain. But don't turn aside, you know, otherwise I'll shut up the heavens. Again, this is under law, not under grace. Under grace it's different, but God still puts us in situations where we need to be completely dependent upon him. And that's not easy. That's not easy. So the farmer, he would work his guts out, but he would always be waiting. He He would always be waiting for these rains to come. He was working and he was waiting. Turn back to James, and we'll have a look what James is saying here. He starts in this passage and he says, "Therefore, be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord." Remember, these Jewish believers were persecuted. They were abused. They were scattered everywhere. And James is saying, be patient. The Lord's coming. Be patient until the Lord comes. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, waiting patiently for it until he receives the early and the latter rain. Who here likes waiting? Or waiting patiently? No one. You know, it's something within our natures. We live in an absolute instant society, probably becoming more and more instant as it goes. And we don't like, I said to Wendy the other night, "Do you think I'm very patient?" And she just about fell off a chair with laughter, because she listed this big list of things I hadn't even thought of, you know. And no, I'm probably one of the worst. I hate waiting, you know. She said to me, "You can't even wait for your birthday for your present. You've got to get it before your birthday." It's no good Christmas, anything like that. She can't even put them out. I'm incredibly impatient for things like that. But it's like that. We all struggle with waiting patiently. It's interesting, when I was thinking about it, I was watching the kids. It's just something in us, we just don't like waiting. Have you ever watched kids when they know a friend's going to come around? Let's say a friend is going to come around at such and such a time. They'll get up, they'll have breakfast, it might be midday they're coming. But if you look out the door and they're down by the gate, you know, or they're up a tree right by the gate waiting, you know. And they're hours ahead of time, but they know someone's coming. And they're down there and they're asking you, what's the time? And they're down there waiting, they don't want to be late, and they've got hours to go. You know? Kids.
I'm grown up.
Yeah. And James is saying here, look, you've got to be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. In the same way that the farmer waited for his precious fruit to come to maturity, he was dependent upon God. Things are, for the farmer, it was worth, if he knew he was going to get a good produce, it was worth waiting for. Because the end result is that good, it's worth waiting for. I was thinking about, I planted a plum tree this year, a Louisa plum, and as quite a few other people did, we've got this little garden club going in the home group, you know. And when we get to home group, we talk for half an hour on gardening, and then we get down to business. But we all bought these sort of Louisa plums, and because it's only the first year of fruiting, really, and we're all comparing how many we had, and I had three. I had three, and I've been watching these three all year, you know. Once they'd formed, I've been watching them, and two disappeared. I don't know where they went, but I got no idea. They mysteriously disappeared and they left me with one. So I was watching this one plum intently because I wanted to get one plum off this tree. And when it finally came about, I saw it started getting big. It's a Louisa, and those ones are the yellow in the middle. I picked it as soon as it was starting to get yellow, because I thought, I'm not going to lose this one. I picked it and I put it in the kitchen, and me and Wendy watched it, you know. And we were feeling it all the time. And the other day we cut it in half. Cut it in half and cut the pip out. And it was as close to heaven as you could get. Honestly, it was the juiciest thing you've ever tasted. And me and Wendy just ate half a plum each. And it was so nice. We were so happy over our one plum, you know. And but this is like the farmer. If he knows what the end result is, if he knows he's going to get something good, then it's worth waiting for. But it's like that with the coming of the Lord. If you know what the end result is, all you've got to do is spend a little time in the presence of Christ And you go, yeah, this is it. This is what I actually live for. You know? And there's a day coming, James is saying, for all of these Jewish believers, wait patiently, don't give up hope. The coming of the Lord is actually near. And it'll be a day that we've never ever tasted or experienced when we are brought into fullness in Christ. It won't be a day like it. And James is saying, wait patiently. When it comes to patience, we don't have it, but it's something that can be learned. Interesting, when you look through Scripture and you read some of the verses on patience, like in James, he says, in the start of chapter 1, he says about trials, let patience have its perfect work. In other words, don't try and fight against what is happening to you, but trust God and let it have its time. Because God is working things into our lives and he knows what's best. Don't try and shortcut the process as we try and do, because we want to get out of things as quick as we can. But trust God in them. Don't try and shortcut it. Let it have its perfect work. Romans talks about tribulation produces patience. Again, something we don't like, but there's an outworking of it. When you think about patience and waiting, we all have to wait for things at times in our lives. Even Christ, I was thinking the other day, he had to wait 30 years before he was ready to actually start his ministry. He would have been ready, well, yeah, you saw him at 12, confounding the scribes, you know. So, but God allowed him to wait an exact period of time, you know, no time before, no time after, until, yeah, now's the time. And he waited that whole time. And then when he comes up out of the water, God says about him, this is my beloved son with whom I am well pleased. What had he done for 30 years? Nothing. But yet he pleased God. He hadn't done anything for 30 years, but he pleased the Father. And God has said, now's the time. Now's the time. And he goes forth. Yeah. So these things are worked out not only with Christ, but also with us. He says, verse 8, you also be patient, establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. When you read the New Testament, the Lord's, it's in 21, I think, out of 27 books in the New Testament, speaks about his second coming. And the disciples, they heard his words in John 14, let not your heart be troubled. I go away to another place to prepare a place for you. I will come again and receive you unto myself. The disciples knew those words, that I will come again. They saw him ascend. They saw him descend to earth and ascend to his Father. And the angel said, in the same way that he has gone, he will come again. So the disciples knew that his coming was imminent. In other words, it was actually going to be soon and it could happen at any stage. That's what imminent meant. And for those disciples, they really believed that he was coming in their lifetime. They truly believed that he was coming in their lifetime. In the same way that they saw him go, they believed that he was going to come again. And when the New Testament talks about the coming of Christ, it actually talks about it in that light, that it's imminent, that it can happen at any stage. And for those disciples, they were persecuted, they were hated, they were abused, but they hang on to that great hope, that blessed hope, that I will come again. The second coming of Christ. And the years went over and he didn't return, and it turned into decades, and those decades turned into centuries. And it was about 313 when Constantine became emperor, and the official religion, supposedly he became a Christian, and the official religion of the empire became Christianity. He took upon himself the title Vicar of Christ. But up to that point, this I will come again and the blessed hope of his return and the imminency of his return, first of all, began to be neglected, and then it was virtually abandoned. And the church went from being persecuted and hated to accepted. And the official religion of the state was Christianity under Constantine. And the church went from being persecuted to married to the world, where you've got Satan's attempts on persecuting and destroying a church on one hand, Then you've got the other side where it's accepted and legalized and all the trouble that came from them, because before then, the believers were just persecuted. They met, they were scattered, they met in homes, all that type of thing, you know. They traveled from place to place. They reckon when Constantine came into power, one out of every 10 in the kingdom was a Christian. Probably similar to now, you know. I mean, they give you percentages on people in, what do they say about New Zealand, 3% or something. It might be, you could probably whittle that down a little bit maybe. Anyway, yeah, that was about that, 1 in 10. So, but you, church buildings went up. There became positions in the church. The wealthy flooded in because they could get ahead, you know. Everything got really mixed. Out of that come Catholicism and the need to bring Christ's rule on earth. And they took the sword and, you know, you convert or you die. It just, and it went. But the hope of his return actually was abandoned. And you don't hear, when you read writings, you don't hear much of it. It was probably about in the 1600s, the Puritans, those that were really dedicated to the scriptures, they started talking about it again. Then the Plymouth Brethren through the 1700s, and then you get to about probably in the 1900s a lot more, you know. And probably in the 70s and 80s you had stacks of evangelical writers again bringing up this doctrine that had always been in the scriptures, that I will come again and receive you unto myself, that his coming was imminent. And you had lots of people like Hal Lindsey and all of those type of people, end times writers, talking about them. Unfortunately, you also had all the kooks as well. In 1988, you had a book written, 88 Reasons Why Christ is going to Return in 88, followed by, in 1989, was 89 Reasons Why Christ would Return in 89, and you had lots of date setters and all of that sort of stuff. But it still remains true that Christ's return is imminent. Yet you come to today and all is very quiet. I know when I first came to the Lord in about 1990, all through the 90s, it was just, didn't matter what church you went into, you heard lots about it. You know, people were looking and the coming of the Lord is near, and it was on everyone's lips, and you had the, you know, all the Barry Smiths and those sort of things using world events with his coming, and that was all good, and everything was heading towards sort of the year 2000, and everyone was getting a bit, oh, you know, but nothing happened, and it's gone really quiet. You know, you don't hear much about it. I don't hear much about it. So yeah, which begs a question: do you think he could come today? Do you think he could come today?
Yes.
Do you think he will come today? Because I said this to my 10-year-old boy yesterday. I said, do you think that Christ will come today? And he said, no. And he said, and then he thought about it and he said, oh, maybe 10%? And I said to him, remember the scripture that the Son of Man cometh at an hour that you think not. And he said to me, well, that means that's every hour. See? I thought, yeah, see, you bang on. Like, because really, we know that the promises are there, but we don't actually live like it. Like, if you knew that Christ was coming back today, what would you be doing? You'd probably be doing something quite different with your day, you know. If you really knew he was coming, probably instant, and we're all the same, we don't live like it, you instantly, your concern would be, if Christ was coming today, your concern would be for what? For what? Is the house clean? Yeah. No, it'd be for people. It would be. It'd be for others. It'd be for those that don't know him. Instantly, you wouldn't care about anything else because it's all meaningless. But you would care about people, you know. But we are all the same. We know that he's coming again, but we don't live like that, you know. I don't know how you get into actually living like that he could come today, so you live like that, because I don't, honestly, you You know, I think about his coming, but I don't live like he's coming today. You know, we should, but we don't. Yeah. And James is saying, you also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. So the fact that he's saying we need to establish our hearts, it means that you need to look at these things, take stock of what your life is about. Establish your hearts. Remember that the promise is there, that I will come again and receive you unto myself. The Jewish wedding is another really good picture of this thing. You know, the Jewish wedding, the groom would go away and he'd build a little house on the side of his parents' house, and he'd go away for an extended period of time while the bride would wait, and she would have to wait and wait, but she would have to be looking all the time because he would come back for her at a time that he chose and then take her to the wedding procession. Then all of that would carry on. But in the meantime, the bride just had to wait patiently and look, you know. The Jewish, there's so much in the Jewish faith that is so along the right lines, you know, for these sorts of pictures. But we need to establish our hearts and keep looking. I heard a story of there was a man over in Switzerland looking at a villa, and as he looked over the gate, he saw this most beautiful villa and beautiful grounds. And he went through the gate and met the caretaker. He went in, and the caretaker showed him around, and it was the most beautiful villa right down on the lake, all gorgeous gardens and land. And the man asked the caretaker, "How long have you been here?" And he said, 24 years. And he said, "Have you, where is the owner?" And he said, "He lives overseas. Has he visited?" "Yes, he's visited 4 times." "When's the last time you saw him?" "I saw him 12 years ago." And he said, "Well, how do you get paid?" And he said, "He's got an agent in such and such a land." "Does he come often?" "Never." "Does the owner write to you?" "No, he's never written to me." So, and he said, "Well, who does come and view this?" And he said, "Virtually no one. I'm here most of the time alone." And he said to the man, "Well, look at all this. This is so beautiful, perfect, pristine. You've got it, and you've got it as though your master is coming back tomorrow." And the old man turned to him and said, no, "I've got it as though he's coming back today." And I thought that's actually a really good example of establishing your hearts and living our lives as though he was coming today. Because he could come today. The coming of the Lord is imminent. So James, in this passage, He's talking to these Jews that are persecuted, hated, abused, and he's saying, look, establish your hearts. Be like a farmer. The farmer he works hard, but yet his eyes are continually on the skies. He's looking toward the heavens continually. Any sign of a changing wind or a cloud that's forming, this is what the farmer's looking for. Yeah, rain's on the way, you know, and that's going to bring about the harvest. And James is saying the same to these Jews here. Be patient. The coming of the Lord is at hand. With whatever it is you're going through, it's only in him that you'll find your life and your help. And, yeah, be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. When you look at what's happening in the world, me and Chris were just talking this morning, when you look at what's happening, like Christ could have come at any stage for the last 1900 years. There was nothing that had to be fulfilled that stops him coming for his bride. And when you look at the earth today, there's unrest everywhere. You know, at the moment, it's I know there's always been stages through history where there's been unrest, but there's just lots going on, you know, lots of unrest economically, lots of unrest politically, lots of unrest naturally, you know. The earth and nature just seems to be increasingly doing crazy things, you know, and it's getting shorter, as in the birth pangs, like what Jesus said in Matthew 24, you know, just like the pains of a woman. Things will get a quicker frequency, and it's time to keep watching, you know. Just where me and Chris were talking this morning about what's happening in the Middle East, you'd never have picked that Egypt would fall like that. It's possible that Libya Bahrain and those other countries. It's just, yeah. It's unusual things. What other things do you see happening in the world? Like, if you're looking at it, what are some of the things that you see on the horizon?
Lawlessness.
Lawlessness, yep. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Western societies are changing radically, you know. They really are.
Selfishness.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'd say Japan's in a very dodgy situation at the moment. With its no birth rate,
yeah. I hadn't heard that. No birth rate.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's worldwide at the moment, and that's the, it used to be pockets of things, but there just seems to be so much, and it's, for me, it is just a sign of the times that things are getting messy. No, well, yeah. Yeah. So we don't know how bad things will get for the West, I think. I think the West is in for a lot of change and trouble. But just like these Jews, you know, we've got a hope that's in Christ and, yeah, in his return.